Hey everyone, welcome to another book club exclusive podcast. I'm Carolyn Ahrens, and today I'm so excited because I get to talk to our two guides for Life Without Lack, the editors of the book. I think you've already been getting to know them. First, we have Larry Berthoff with us. How are you doing, Larry?
Doing well. Good to be with you.
Great. Thank you. And then we have Rebecca Willard-Heatley, who you'll probably hear me referring to as Becky from here on out. How are you doing today, Becky?
Great, Carolyn. Excited to get to spend this time with you.
We are so grateful. And we've been learning so much already. And if it's okay with you, I'll just dive in with some questions that I have to do with this kind of first chunk of the book. So where we're at with the club, as you know, the members have already read the preface through chapter one. And this week, they're going to be reading chapters two and chapter three. And the first question I have has to do with this idea. Larry, you write in the preface that Dallas was carefree, but not without care for others. And then, you know, later by the time we got into chapter one, Dallas was talking about the Apostle Paul being content, at ease, free of anxiety in any circumstances. And I realized when I was reading those sections that I'm not sure if I know what care for someone else looks like apart from worry. I think especially as a parent, as a mom, I've sometimes thought it was my job to worry about my kids. And so I have a couple questions that flow out of that. The first one is, did either of you ever see Dallas worry about himself or about someone else he loved? And in asking that, I'm trying to get down to the question of what does it look like to care for other people without worry? Is that even possible? You guys got thoughts about that?
I've got thoughts, but I think Becky ought to take this one first.
Oh.
Well, because you saw Dallas in familial context and where, you know, I don't know that there was a whole lot of difference between the Dallas in your home and the Dallas outside where all the rest of us saw him.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Okay. Well, I think, you know, my first reaction is really to the second part of your question. The caring for others in a worry-free way makes me think of the story of, I believe it was the first Renovare Institute cohort, that one of the members there asked my dad if he could describe Jesus with one word, what would that word be? And my dad's answer was relaxed.
Yeah.
And I think that that's how I think that's what this looks like, to care for other people in a worry-free way. You think about how Jesus was always interruptible and ready to help, you know, whoever, the woman that touched his garment or the widow whose son had died. And just, you know, he didn't act like he was too busy for you, but he was also very calm in whatever he was doing. You know, he comes down from the Mount of Transfiguration and these guys have been trying to cast this demon out and failing. And he doesn't, you know, I mean, he scolds them a little, but it's not all stressed out kind of a scolding. Right. And I think that's, it's a difference in our attitude. And, you know, I worry about my daughter too. But it's understanding that, yes, she's going to college in another state, but God is there with her. And ultimately she is in God's hands wherever she goes. If she's out late at night driving by herself or whatever it is, that ultimately all of this is in God's hands. And so I do my part and then leave space for God to do his part. Yeah. And I think that's what I saw in my dad, you know, modeled always. He was just so very calm all the time.
Hmm. Yeah, I was thinking that, no, I'm sure. I mean, as an aside, I had to tell myself, or I thought, you know, I got to be aware of exalting Dallas above the need for Christ. Right? I mean, he needed Christ too, obviously. And he was down the road quite a bit and could help the rest of us navigate life. And so I couldn't think of a particular instance in all the time I knew him and interactions I had with him where I saw him really worried, but I knew he had concerns. I don't know always what the inner life was like exactly going on. But on the exterior, like Becky said, there was a calm, there was a relaxation there. A phrase came to mind that freedom from fear is a freedom to serve. And so that's kind of what I was getting at there when I said he didn't have consternation or worry, but he sure was free to care because he wasn't all wrapped up in the, you know, like Becky, you say you're worried about your daughter. And I wonder if, I don't know, there's some sort of line here between worry and just pure concern. I think we probably kind of slosh back and forth over the two of those. And we have to catch ourselves, I think, when we think there's no one there for her or there's no one there for you know, us. Or, oh, no, wait a minute. No, there is. And there's the one who can meet any and all needs. And that's growth and faith. I mean, later on in the book, obviously, Dallas is going to talk about moving through stages of faith. And
I think that the knowledge of God and how well Dad had come to know God allowed him to sort of rest in the goodness of God, you know, that he implicitly trusted that God was in control and would handle everything. And so that's another way that the worry, you know, can shift into just a more casual concern of that line that you're talking about.
Or a trust. Yeah. I was suddenly remembering, I think it's in Divine Conspiracy where, Becky, where your dad says that the address at the beginning of the Lord's Prayer is so important, that addressing God is what makes prayer and not worrying out loud. once you take that worry and you communicate it to God, then it turns into prayer. So I'm wondering if, Larry, when you distinguish between concern and worry, it's like the concern is natural and normal about the people that we love. The question maybe is whether it goes to prayer or it goes to worry. Does the concern flow to prayer or does it flow to worry?
Right. And for a long time, I've thought, it's just this very subtle but absolutely significant and important shift in our intention or awareness from worry to prayer. It's just a shifting and a realization and a remembering, a reminding ourselves or being reminded, oh, Lord, here's this situation. I don't know what's going to happen with it. And I find myself thinking there's no way out or whatever it might be. But even in stating that, which would sound like I'm worried, just what I probably am, I'm praying. I'm engaging the answer to those worries and to the answer to the to whatever the issue is.
Yeah. That's really
helpful. So I have a question for you guys. I have heard preachers, teachers say that worry is a sin. Is worry a sin?
Not when I do it. Is worry a sin?
I used to really struggle with worry, and then you add that on top of it. Oh, great, I'm sinning too. Thank you.
That's a good point. My thought is, okay, worry is a symptom, right, of a lack of a certain vision of who God is and his ability to make all things right. It's not what, you know, in some biblical translations, right, the high-handed sin of waving our fist in God's face. I'd have a really hard time putting it in the category of sin, and yet there's some other category. It's a lack of perfect faith, but lo and behold, that's where we're all at and moving, hopefully, to a more centered faith. So I don't know. What do you think, Carol?
It's a tricky question. I think it depends if we're talking about worry as an emotion or worry as a habit pattern. So, I think our emotions like you said, Larry, they're just smoke signals or symptoms. They help us go, oh, what are you trying to show me here? What needs to be recalibrated? And they can actually be really helpful. So if I notice that I'm worrying, that can be very helpful. And part of just being fully human and invested in my relationships and loving other people. But if hurry becomes my habitual way of dealing with concern for people that I love or for situations, I think it can become a sinful pattern, and it will probably lead to other sinful patterns like attempting to control other people or situations. I wouldn't want to add to, somebody who is wrestling with anxiety, now you have to be anxious that
you're sinning.
I used to have a problem when of crying in school when I was really little. I was really shy. And one time I was in the principal's office in kindergarten. My mom came to pick me up and she said, "Why did you start crying?" And I said, "Because I was so afraid I was going to cry. That's why I started crying." Right? So we don't want to get in those kind of cycles. So I think it can be helpful. Just in this conversation with you, I'm seeing for me, it can be helpful. Okay, this is a symptom. This is a sign. Now, what am I going to do with this now that the spirit is helping me become aware of this? And that's where there's opportunities.
That's good. Yeah, like pain is a symptom. There's something wrong in your body.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I think of that response of the man in the scripture where he said, he's got his son sick, right? And if you believe, and he says, "Well, I believe, help my unbelief." So worry is that space in between those two, right? Between believing and, I need some more. I need some more faith here. So it occupies that land between complete faith and got some questions.
Yeah. Well, and then Jesus says, when the disciples say in that story, with the healing of the boy, when they say, "Why didn't it work when we tried to cast this out of the boy?" And Jesus says, "This kind can only come out by prayer." Yeah. Kind of, which seems to hint that the disciples even were still trying to do it in their own strength and not turning to prayer. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to really think about that. Does my concern turn into prayer, or does it turn into habitual patterns of worry? And that really helps me.
Yeah, that's good.
Thank you, guys. Well, very closely related to this idea of being carefree is this idea of contentment. It really rings out through the whole book. Again, early in the preface, Larry, you talk about the fact that Dallas had learned to be content in all things. He could say that alongside the Apostle Paul. And it got me thinking about all there's sort of a popular idea in the culture that we need to stay hungry so that we're going after things, so that we're, not complacent. I guess maybe that's what I'm trying to get at. We might misread content as complacent. And so that made me want to ask some questions. Again, I'm always so curious about Dallas personally, because you guys can help us with that. He accomplished tons. He was a very respected professor, wrote lots of books. Was there any sense in which he had, professional ambition? I'm trying to, can I ask that? Is there, how did he accomplish so much as such a deeply content person? And I realize me even asking the question betrays certain biases in the way I'm thinking about contentment, but help me.
Well, my mom frequently tells a story that he would say that rather than having a career, he had a careen, because it just seemed like he kept sort of falling into different things. And, people invited him to write books, and he never wrote a book and then tried to push it himself. He never had to do a book proposal and pitch his book. And so there's some of that there, but he loved learning. He loved helping people. And that was more of his initiative than anything else, I think, that he was not so focused on his own professional advancement. And in fact, there he gave a talk at a luncheon for the C.S. Lewis Foundation a long time ago, and we put a transcript on our website. And so he said, once he got into philosophy, he says, "I decided I would do nothing to try to secure myself or gain advancement. I am very much a literalist in the terms of the Bible. And the Bible says promotion does not come from the East or the West. It comes from the Lord. So, okay, I don't have to do anything about promotion. But what I did was I said, I am going to do the best work I can by God's help. And that meant in writing and teaching. And once again, it wasn't that I was smart. The Lord just guided me. So I worked on papers and my ideas. And then he talks about he would submit his papers to journals. And if God wanted them to be published, they would be. And so that was his attitude, really, to just do the best work he could. And when he speaks on business things, you'll hear him say that, you know, that you do the best work you can, and that Christians should be known for being the best workers, because we are working unto the Lord.
Yeah, I was thinking about this whole thing about ambition, and it led me to, I think ambition is good. It's a neutral thing, because it depends upon what the object of our ambition is, you know, what we're trying to accomplish. And then I thought about, like the Pharisee, you know, in the Sermon on the Mount, right? You know, don't do this to be seen. Don't pray to be seen. Don't fast to be seen. Don't give your alms to be seen, right? That's the ambition there, was to be seen, not to accomplish what God would have us accomplished through praying and almsgiving and so forth. Paul was ambitious. He pushed, but for what reason? He says, I think it's in Philippians or wherever it is, to be found in Christ, to reach a goal that is Christ-centered. And so I think, and we should be, in a sense, I think, ambitious about that. But we shouldn't be ambitious about being known.
Right.
I mean, if I get known, great. I mean, now, that's easy for me to say. I often find myself thinking about what others are thinking about me. And that's another opportunity, just like worry. When you become self-conscious of it, or God conscious of it, you can say, "Oh, wait a minute, Lord."
That's really helpful. And the idea of being that we can be, in a sense, driven towards a telos by a love of learning, by wanting to glorify God, by a desire to do good work, but to be okay with the outcome. Maybe that's where the contentment piece comes in. And like you said, Larry, being known. Later in the book, there's a place where Dallas says, "Imagine if you went to work and you told your coworkers that you lacked for nothing." I think this is on page 45. And he says, "You are supposed to lack. That's one of the things people use to manage you."
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, such an interesting line. And so, if you're doing something out of lack rather than doing something out of love, love of learning, love for God, love for doing great work, you're going to be, your contentment level is going to be very different, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Super helpful. All right. Yeah. You're helping me. So content doesn't mean complacent, but it means really whatever you're doing it out of abundance and trust and love than out of lack. Does that seem fair?
Yeah. I was thinking that contentment will always be having what you need at the moment. You know, with the whole coronavirus thing and the early, I suppose it's still going on, but people, you know, the whole toilet paper thing, I got to get all the toilet paper I'd ever possibly need for the next year. That's not contentment in the moment. I have enough for now. I have what I need to accomplish or to work at what I sense God is having me to work at now. I have what I need. Like I mean, so contentment is another form of freedom, a freedom a freedom to be productive in whatever way we need to be productive, you know, as husband, as wife, as, you know, as a business owner, whatever it might be.
Yeah, because you're letting go of all that other worry, and yes, you can focus on what the task is you need to be doing, or the person in front of you, or whatever it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Contentment is a form of decluttering.
Right? There you go.
Yeah.
That's good.
That's really good. Yeah. Mm. Becky, do you know if your dad was, we've already talked about how calm he was, how content, was he just temperamentally that way, or was it something he grew into? Have you heard stories about that?
I think it's some of both. The way that he grew up, you know, in poverty on the farm, and with his mother's death when he was so young, and kind of living with different relatives throughout his childhood and such. I think it helped him to really appreciate small things and to find joy in just being with your family and in nature in particular. So I think there's some of it that he just kind of grew up with, but he definitely grew in that as he was older. And you can really see that in the biography that Gary Moon wrote. You can kind of see the progression and having dad and my Aunt Bertha, who pretty much raised my dad, you know, how they talk about his childhood and stuff and the growing up. So yeah, I think it's both. It would be both.
Yeah. There has to be something supernatural there in the sense of, you know, we talk about that so many of our parents who grew up during wartime or time when there was scarcity. Mm-hmm. It's been very hard for that generation not, you know, they always have to have the pantries full and they all, you know, because of having grown up in scarcity. And so for him to have such a kind of abundance mindset, given how he grew up,
that's true, because there are others of the same generation that can't throw anything away because they might need it later and you know, do have that attitude of scarcity.
Yeah, so something special there and hopeful.
Well, again, it goes back to what you know of God, and knowing God well enough that you know you can count on his character to provide what you need.
Yeah, that's it, isn't it? All right, let me push a little bit more about this contentment and carefree business. I'm thinking about in the introduction where Dahl says, a life without lack, and here's really the thesis, the heart of the book, a life without lack is a life in which one is completely satisfied and sustained no matter what happens. Now, which is so powerful and so beautiful, and the vision and the reason we're reading the book. But I think if we don't read carefully, we could think that Dallas is advocating just being stoic, like a kind of stoicism, or even like a Buddhist-like surrendering of attachment to anything. Can you help me get clarity around what Dallas means by complete satisfaction? Like, is there a place for saying, no, this is not what God intended for his creation. I'm going to push back against an injustice, you know, that sort of thing. How do we think about what he means by complete satisfaction with the world as it currently is?
I was thinking about, first of all, that the Buddhist likes, you know, surrendering of attachment. Actually, there is some of that, right? I mean, chapter six on death to self, it is a surrendering of attachment of sorts, right? And what we're attached to, of course, is a certain view of ourselves and what we think, you know, all of that. And we give it up into God's hands when we recognize that God really is for us and with us and so forth. And so we're freely giving up improper views of ourselves and so forth. But you said stoicism and Buddhism. I think what both of those are missing, which is key to a life without lack, is the Lord, the shepherd, the one who provides the sufficiency. I just think that the complete satisfaction can't be separated from a dynamic, living interaction with and relationship with the God who has no lack.
Right.
And it all flows right from there.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of the examples that he gives in the book of David and of Paul and all that they had been through. And yet David could still say, the Lord is my shepherd. And Paul could still say, you know, that in plenty and in want, I have learned that I have everything that I need. And so I think he was trying to follow those models and help us to look at that and see that, even when David, you know, had this incredible relationship with the Lord, right? He's still being persecuted and hiding in caves, and Saul is chasing after him and everything. And, but that he still knew where he stood with God, and that God was his shepherd. And that, so I think he's just trying to encourage us to see those models and have that same thought.
Yeah, that's really helpful. I think so. I know people. I think part of where the question comes from for me is I know people really involved in social justice initiatives who are pushing back the darkness in areas where there's systems of racism or injustice, institutionalized poverty, things like that. And they would say that when they get up in the morning, there is a holy dissatisfaction that drives what they do, that they know that this isn't what God intended for his world. And so they're partnering with God. So is it just some semantics here, or would Dallas have had, would he have had a place for that kind of holy dissatisfaction in the way he saw the world? Do you know what I'm getting at?
I think so. I mean,
yeah. I don't care clearly, but hopefully you do.
We'll soon find out. Whether I get it or not. Satisfied with God, but not with the state of things.
Right.
I mean,
that's good.
In both the spirit of the disciplines and in the divine conspiracy, he's got chapters on how to deal with, you know, with social justice issues and mm-hmm. a world gone wrong. And of course it's centered and grounded in having new people, a new kind of person. So who's deeply grounded and rooted in the God who meets all of our needs. But so it's an overflow. I was thinking about saying this earlier. In the preface of the book, we placed the passage 2 Corinthians 9:8 there, which reads, God is able to make all grace abound towards you, that you, always having all sufficiency in all things, that's a lot of alls, may have an abundance for every good work. Notice the connection between a life of sufficiency, a life that does not lack, a life that is anxiety-free or worry-free, and the ability to engage in every good work. And I think part of identifying what some of those good works would be come from having what you just, the phrase you just used, Carolyn, a holy dissatisfaction. Things are not right, and therefore I need to go there and do a good work, which is whatever it would be to alleviate the issue or the problem. So.
Yeah, that is really helpful. That connection between I have enough to be able to now go partner with the Lord in what he wants to do in redeeming and restoring all things. Yeah, it actually takes me back to our first thing we discussed, that does our concern turn into prayer, or does it turn into worry? And like here, does our concern on a big scale, does it turn into the kind of action where it's like, well, God, you're clearly not taking care of this, so I'm going to go do it for you in my own resources and quickly get burned out? Or does it turn into, I know this isn't what you want for your world. How are you inviting me and equipping me to partner with you? And do I trust that you'll give me what I need for that? Yeah, mm-hmm. It's just that sort of writ large. The thing that we were talking about, you know, with our kids is the same kind of concern that we have for the world, maybe. That really helps me. Yeah.
I think there are people that are called to go out and address specific issues, you know, and to really dive in and pull people along, and they're gifted in the ways that allow them to do that and be successful. I never saw my dad, you know, jumping on the bandwagon of any of those in particular, but his goal really was to work with teachers and leaders of various kinds, and on occasion he was invited to speak to groups of politicians and government officials and such, but his focus in all of those was always on the heart of the person and how we were being formed spiritually. And from out of that, the way the individual was formed, then, you know, that transformation works from the inside out. And so, like Divine Conspiracy, and how he addressed some of the issues of what was going on in the church and how that could be better. And now with the disappearance of moral knowledge and what's been happening in the universities. And so, you know, he has talked about the power of ideas and how those, our ideas are our mental map. And so if he made any effort at social justice, I would say that it is in trying to help people form their ideas correctly and to reach out to people in leadership. And then once their ideas are formed correctly, and that's getting infused into society from there.
That's really helpful. Yeah. And it helps me to think about that we're probably each called, you know, according to our gifting and our passion mm-hmm. and the things that make us come alive to, you know, we can't do it all. So
right.
what is the shepherd? Where's the shepherd inviting us to walk and cooperate with him?
Yeah. That's that analogy of the body, you know, which part are we? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Really good. Really good.
I was thinking too about, because Dallas's correct understanding about the gospel of the kingdom that is here and now available. We can live in that. And that, yet there's this now and not yet. There still is the now and not yet. Mm-hmm. And as we live in what's available to us now, God and his kingdom, we are able to address the not yet issues. Where our world isn't as God would have it to be, that will someday, of course, be put to right. But we have indeed, you know, a privilege, a calling to engage those not yet places now.
Yeah.
So,
well, speaking of things gone wrong, we are having this conversation in the midst of a pandemic, The three of us are fortunate in that, as far as we know, we're not sick, but we definitely are aware that there's a crescendoing situation around us, people getting sick, an economy in trouble as a result of countermeasures, things like that. And so, Larry, you already did a wonderful job addressing this in the introduction to the book club, but I want to push even further. Do you guys have further ideas of, you know, first of all, if we did a thought experiment, how do you think Dallas would be responding and reacting in this time of the coronavirus? And then is there more we could be leaning into that his ideas in Life Without Lack can help us in this particular season?
I have to say that this pandemic is only the second time since my dad passed away that there has been a world event where I thought, I wish Dad was here to see this. Mm. And the other was when the Pope was selected. But I think he could, you know, be a voice of reason in the midst of this. And I have wondered what he would think. I do think that he would say a lot of things similar to what James Brian Smith did in a recent podcast. I think it was March 25th. And he was talking about certainty and a good future and, you know, just resting in God, having confidence in him and taking advantage of how our lives have changed right now. And James Ryan Smith mentioned that we have more margin in our lives now, and we have an opportunity to spend more time with God and more time with our family. And are we taking advantage of that? So I think that's part of, you know, I see my dad's spirit, how it has spread into those that have worked with him for so long. And I really think that Dad would be saying the same things that Jim had said and encouraging us in that way.
Yeah, I was thinking one of the things that Dallas would do would remind us of the gift of solitude. Now, for those of us who tend to be introverts, we're already sort of, oh, this is not all that bad. But what we do with that solitude, of course, would be key for him. His responses of the words that came to mind, calmly, fearlessly, thoughtful. I mean, that's how he would respond. I don't think he'd be anxious. I really don't. There would be another set of feelings going on that weren't grounded in fear or worry or has the world spun out of God's control? No, it hasn't. Mm-hmm. Our confusions aren't God's confusions, and it's an act of faith to say, well, God is still in control of this, and we don't know exactly what's going on and how God's going to use this, but because we know, back to Becky's point about, because how we know about how the God we know about, the goodness of this God and the greatness of this God, allows us to have the faith that much, much good can come out of this in spite of all the chaos of it. And there's a lot of chaos. There's no doubt about it. I don't think we can be, you know, stick our head in the ground and sort of say, oh, we're not Pollyanna. A life without lack is not a Pollyanna life. Hmm. It's not one that says everything's really fine. Come on. No, there's lots that's not fine. But we can know the calm in the center of it all by knowing God. Mm-hmm. Trusting God.
Yeah, that's really helpful. Yeah. And I do get the sense he would not have stockpiled toilet paper, as was previously mentioned. You know, the what are the invitations here? You know, that maybe there will be more time for solitude. I've discussed that with a few friends, and some of my friends who have younger kids are like, are you kidding me? Like, it's, you know, I'm home with my family 24/7. And so actually a line that really struck me in the book, it's in chapter 3 where Dallas is working out his wonderful theology of work and vocation and calling. But there's a line on page 60 where he says, your work is the total amount of lasting good that you will accomplish in your lifetime. That might include your job, but for many of us, our families will be the largest part of the lasting good we produce. Mm-hmm. And I thought that might be an encouraging word for people that are home with young kids and feeling like they can't get any of their work done right now.
Yeah. Oh, totally. I my daughter's away at college, and I wish so desperately that she was still in high school and she was home with us, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's an opportunity. People tell you, you know, the time that your kids are at home will be gone before you know it. But this is an opportunity. Make some special memories. There's a church near us that they're having, their children's ministry is kind of assigning a challenge every week for the kids. And then they send in pictures or video of what they did. So one week the challenge was to build a fort, you know, and then send in pictures of your fort and there different things like that. But just take the opportunity, you know, spend the extra time with your kids. And maybe you have to, you know, make sure you're defining clear boundaries that I need this many hours, that I have a requirement for my job, that I have to do this, but then we will do something really special. Let the kids plan a surprise for you while you're working, whatever. Right. But it is an opportunity. And like we were talking about solitude, my dad used to use an example of our prayer time and our study time and such. And he would say that the half hour a day or whatever your daily thing, that's great. But sometimes you need a shower. Sometimes you need to take a day with God. And so maybe this is an opportunity to do that. And even with the families that are all at home, maybe there's a way that the parents can work out a way that one parent gets to have this part of the house to themselves for 4 hours and the other parent stays with the kids, and really let yourself take a shower and just bathe in the presence of Christ. Take advantage of what's being offered.
Yeah, that's great. And when we get to chapter 8, I mean, that's really guidance about how to take a nice long shower, right? So hopefully there'll be an invitation there too. That's helpful. Thank you. Well, this has been a huge gift. Can I ask one more thing about these chapters that we're currently immersed in? In chapter 2, Dallas makes this striking statement where he says, what we place our mind on brings that reality into our lives. I know this. There's something huge about this sentence, and I'm still trying to fully understand what it means. It's so important to Dallas. Becky, you were saying earlier, he really felt like if working at the level of ideas was so critical. It's so important to Dallas where we place our minds. And I see Becky pointing at Larry. So Larry, can you help us with this teaching of Dallas?
I was going to point at Becky. His emphasis on our minds, what we should be thinking about. And I think it's important to understand that for him, at least in this book, that what he means by mind is pretty broad, pretty general. He gets more specific in Renovation of the Heart, but it's really what we're thinking about most practically, what we think about, what we imagine, what we concentrate on. And because he says that he didn't include the biblical concept of heart here, which of course has an aspect of it of willing and desiring. So it's this whole sort of package, I guess you'd say, of the way what we worry about. I mean, it's what we put our, what are the ideas? What are the things we're thinking? What are the scenarios we're imagining? All of that plays a part in whether or not we can know and experience this life without lack, sufficiency, and so forth. And what that all needs to be ultimately focused upon or centered around is who God is, what he is like, what he thinks of us, how he's there for us. And I was thinking this emphasis upon the importance of your mind. It's not like Dallas is suggesting a new skill that we need to learn. Like, I don't know how to think about anything. No, we're doing it all the time. We're imagining all the time. We're bringing before our minds situations or scenarios, and that's where a lot of the worry and anxiety comes from. But we just need to bring other things into that picture when we're imagining how things might go wrong. So, I mean, that's what came to mind for me. You know, Dallas is asking us not to do something new, but to do what we do differently with a different content. Thoughts, Becky?
I wouldn't add much to that other than, where we place our mind, he said that brings that reality into our life. And so I think about Philippians 4 and Paul telling us, you know, be anxious for nothing. And then moving down a little bit to thinking about whatever is lovely and whatever is pure and whatever is true. And you get to the end of that, and the peace of Christ is what comes out of that. And that's a good scriptural example of where we place our mind and what the result is. And I like Viktor Frankl, you know, has become fairly commonly known now after his work and his experience in the concentration camps. And his story is so powerful, you know, of getting through that thing and understanding that the one thing that these guards at that camp couldn't take away from him was what he thought about and where he put his mind, and that that's what brought him through that whole experience. And that's powerful. So if we're going to have to live without toilet paper for a few weeks.
Yeah, we might be able to make it.
Yeah, compared to a concentration camp.
Right.
Yeah, Dallas is, I was thinking about, you know, James Brand Smith's phrase, his title of that set of books, you know, The Good and Beautiful, The Good and Beautiful God, that our minds need to be saturated in that vision of who God is and how he's for us. And this is also going to involve, I mean, the use of our minds is also being sort of self-reflective, self-aware of what am I thinking about and how am I thinking about that? And where is God in the midst of all of that? So an awareness, just his putting the emphasis upon the importance of the mind should be a challenge to us and an encouragement to us to think about how we're thinking.
Hmm.
You know, mindful of what our mind is full of, mm-hmm. and where it's going. I after the book was finished, the first two chapters, they've only read one at this point in time, but you know, it's God and Himself part one and God and Himself part two. And it sounds like it would just be two chapters on God, but Dallas is constantly going back and forth in both of these chapters on the importance of how we think and thinking and what we place our mind on and how we think about God. And then he's putting our mind on God mm-hmm. by describing God. So it's this beautiful sort of dance back and forth between both of these, between how we're thinking and the importance of our thinking, and then just who we should be thinking about.
Yeah, yeah. Those two chapters were very powerful for me in the process of working on them, because I had gone through a really nasty few years and I was in a bad place, and to have my job be to focus on the beauty of God in that, you know, the way Dad portrays that in those two chapters, it totally rearranged my attitude and how I felt about entering each day. And just, I mean, to be focused on, to keep God before you like that, I guess is the phrase, right? And it's just powerful how that can change when you are remembering exactly who this God is that is taking care of us right now. And that's what's on your mind. It's hard to worry about toilet paper.
And Dallas, of course, is saying that this isn't just thinking about, this is being with.
Mm-hmm.
But this isn't just thinking about this God who is great and good and so forth. This is being with, and that God being with us.
Mm-hmm.
With God life, of course, which is so central to his understanding and experience. So
yeah.
Norman Vincent Peale has this little booklet called How to Have a Good Day, and in the beginning of it, he says that the first thing you want to do in the morning is spend 2 minutes just thinking about God and how that will retune your attitude toward the day.
Love it.
And allowing that to be a time with God.
That's great. Well, my booklet, How to Have a Good Day, is Have a Conversation with Becky and Larry about good things. This has been a good day indeed. Thank you so much, you guys. And we'll talk again soon about some future chapters, okay?
Great.
Excellent.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.